A lot of what we think about motivation is wrong. We tend to believe that the way that people perform at a higher level is you offer them a reward, you dangle out a carrot in front of them, or you threaten them with a stick. That's how people perform at high levels. And for this book, Drive, I looked at 50 years of research in behavioral science. It shows that's true in some circumstances, but in a very narrow band of circumstances, and for many things, it's just not true. In many cases, those kinds of rewards, what we might think of as if-then rewards, if you do this, Chris, then you get that, they don't work and they often backfire. And yet, and here's what's annoying, when we see them demonstrably not work in our organizations, whether it's a government organization or a for-profit organization, our response isn't to say, oh, maybe we need a new approach. Our response is, looks like we need some more carrots. Looks like we need sharper sticks, and it's taking us down a fundamentally wrong path. And what's and as you know, I'm a little bit peeved about this because it goes against what the science tells us about what motivates human beings.
And yet, over and over again, no one ever talks about changing it, as you mentioned.
No, we take it as a fact of life. The sun comes up in the east, and people are motivated by carrots and sticks. Yeah. It's a completely unchallenged assumption. When you look at the assumption, and the good news here is that for the last 50 years, a whole array of social scientists, from psychologists to sociologists to economists, have examined this in a whole series of laboratory experiments and even field studies, and they show over and over and over again the same thing. For certain kinds of tasks, these carrot and stick motivators are pretty good, but for most of them, they just don't work.
And you talk a little bit about what I've been referring to as motivation 1.0, which is you're the caveman. You got to eat, and so you kill your food, and incredible motivator.
Huge motivator. It's a big basic biological motivation. I mean, if there's a saber-toothed tiger coming after me, right. I'm motivated to escape the saber-toothed tiger.
And motivation 2.0 is this carrot and stick approach. And I think one of the misconceptions that some people had as I was talking to them about the book, even some people who have read the book, was that what you're saying is that we should completely throw out the carrots and the sticks.
Absolutely not. But I think we should use them where they work and dispense with them where they don't work. The problem now is that we think that they work in 100% of circumstances, and they work in a much smaller portion of that.
And talk about a couple of the stories that you tell in here, and one of my favorite ones was the daycare center.
Oh, that's an awesome one. I mean, again, it just shows you. So this is a study of some Israeli daycare centers. And so they noticed, so the rule at this daycare center was you had to pick up your kids by 4 in the afternoon. If you didn't pick up your kids by 4 in the afternoon, the caregiver had to stay late. They noticed some parents coming late, so they did what I would have done, what all of us would have done as we sort of seek to guide human behavior. You charge the parents,
right?
So they put up a big sign, fine for coming late. Parents are, the rule is you got to be here by 4. Some parents are coming late, so we're going to impose a fine. It was 10 Israeli shekels at the time, maybe 5-6 bucks. Every time you're late for every kid, you got to pay this fine. Okay, so of course it had a big effect on the behavior. We have this deterrence. We have a fine. We're trying to deter the bad behavior. They impose the fine, and lo and behold, the incidence of lateness doubled. So they put in a punishment designed to deter behavior, and it ends up doubling the rate of behavior they were trying to deter. And so what this shows us is, first of all, that people were showing up on time for moral relationship reasons. They didn't want to inconvenience the caregiver. Once you put a price on it, it becomes another transaction. It's like buying a bag of corn chips. If you want 2 bags of corn chips, you pay double the amount. And what it also shows is this premise that I think underlies a lot of our organizations, private and public, is that people are endlessly manipulable, that if you just press the right levers in the right way, people will respond the way that you expect them to. And that's just not true.
I see. So the stick in this case was the fine.
Yeah.
If you pick up your kid late.
Yeah.
And when it becomes just another business transaction, my attitude as a mom might be, well, I'm paying you extra. So I can take a little bit longer.
Oh, sure. I'm not saying that the people who decided to show up late were acting immorally in any way.
No, but now it's a business transaction.
You got it, exactly. And it becomes essentially a cost benefit analysis. So you could say, you know, I got 3 kids. If my elder daughter was in, you know, federal daycare. And so if I were to go pick up, you know, if I had this rule at this daycare center, and I don't remember what the rule was at our daycare center, but I was always so nervous about getting there on time.
Yeah, you see parents run around panicked.
If they say, okay, it's $10 for showing up late, there could be times at work when I say, it's worth paying that fine in order to stay a little bit later. Now, what it doesn't do is it sort of crowds out my concern with the caregiver. The caregiver has to stay late. The caregiver is not getting paid. The caregiver might be late to go pick up his or her own kid. And so, you know, again, the point of all this is that we have this notion that people are, as I mentioned before, endlessly manipulable. And that if we just dole out the right carrot and the right stick, if we have this architecture of rewards and punishments in the right way, people are going to do what we want them to do. And that's just not true.
One of the other examples that you use, and it's one that I've mentioned a number of times, is the Wikipedia versus the Encarta example. Being the Microsoft. If you had talked to any economist out there 20 years ago and said, okay, Microsoft is going to create this encyclopedia. They're going to have this entire team talk about rewards. You can become a very wealthy person if this is successful.
Yeah.
And they are going to have their clocks cleaned by these 11 people who set up this wiki that people contribute to it. It goes against what we all feel like is the way that this should work.
If you had proposed, okay, so we're talking about open source, people who create software and other things for free. They do complicated work with people they don't know for no money and give away their product. Now, imagine if I had, you know, I go back 25 years ago when I took my first economics course in college, and imagine me going to my professor in my economics course and saying, hey, professor, can I talk to you for a second? I want to run something past you. I got this idea for a business model. Here's how it works. You get a bunch of people around the world. They don't know each other, but they all decide to do incredibly technically sophisticated work for free. All right, so she's already looking at me like I'm insane. Oh, and I'm not done though. Then all these people doing technically sophisticated work for free decide to give away their product for nothing.
See, no, already you lost me.
Yeah, right. She's saying, well, that's what she would have said. She would have said, well, maybe Mr. Pink, you should major in comparative literature. And I say, oh, it's going to be huge. Trust me. I mean, she would have thought I was insane. It seemed to defy the laws of behavioral physics. It would have been like saying to your physics professor, hey, I've got this steel ball here that I'm holding aloft in the air. And when I let go of it, it's not going to drop to the ground because the law of gravity doesn't apply in this circumstance. It's going to float up into the air. And they would have said, all right, time for you to reread the campus drug policy.
But how do these things become so, they're now so ingrained in us, and even as Amy and I were talking about, you could see it in her. She would go, no, that's just not right. It's not possible.
We actually kind of got into a little fight about it.
Right. Well, that's what it seems like. And it's not like, I mean, it's based, you know, there, one of the things that's interesting is that we have certain assumptions that we never examine. And our assumptions really dictate our path. And you can look at it, you know, if you believe that the sun goes around the earth and the earth is the center of the universe, then you're probably not going to be very good at navigation. You're starting from the wrong premise. But if you start from the other premise that the earth goes around the sun, you might get things a little bit more right. And we have a premise about people I think it's a very insidious premise in organizations, is that, and you hear it from managers, is that basically people are fundamentally slugs. That manager will say this explicitly, if I didn't wield this stick or offer this carrot, people would just sit there and do nothing. That basically our nature is to be passive and inert. And I think that's the wrong premise about human nature. I think our nature is to be active and engaged. I've never seen a 2-year-old kid who's not active and engaged, or a 4-year-old who's not active and engaged. But if you start with the premise that people are fundamentally passive and inert, that's going to take you down one path. But if you start with a different premise, that people actually are active, engaged, want to do good work, I think it takes you down a different path. It is a kinder and gentler path, but it's also a more effective path.
So what's the risk if you take that path that people want to be more engaged and maybe you run into some people who aren't so much? What's the big risk?
I agree. There isn't that much of a risk. I think the bigger risk, I mean, I think it's a profound point in a way, in that what you have is you have people more concerned about momentary failure than about widespread irredeemable mediocrity. I think that's the problem. And I, you know, this is my newest obsession, which is I think people are much more concerned about failure than about mediocrity, and it should be the reverse. For, you know, really simple routine rule-based kinds of tasks, things that are relatively straightforward. Carrot and stick motivators are not the end of the world. They actually work pretty well. But I think that throughout the white-collar workforce, and certainly in a huge, huge, huge portion of the federal workforce, people aren't doing routine work. They're doing more sophisticated, complex, conceptual work. And for that, three things seem to lead to enduring motivation. Autonomy, which is self-direction, control over how you work, when you work, where you work. Mastery, which is really important and often overlooked, this sense of getting better at something that matters, making progress in your work. And finally, a sense of purpose, the idea that what you're doing is connected to something larger than yourself, that you're making a contribution to something that goes beyond you. And I think that in these things are much harder to put in place, but they prove to be much more enduring motivators, and they have far fewer of the side effects of the traditional suite of carrot and stick motivators.
Of the three of those, yeah. I think people get purpose, and particularly I think people in the federal space get purpose.
Sure.
Mastery, I think the autonomy one is one that becomes, I think, a little bit more complex. So can you talk a little bit about that? And I think from a manager's point of view, it must be giving somebody that kind of autonomy just has to be scary.
It's very scary because it calls into question the whole idea of management, which is another notion that we don't scrutinize enough. We take management as if it came from God or emanated from nature, when in fact management is simply a technology. Management is a technology for organizing people to do productive work. Some guy invented it. It's a technology from the 1850s. And so there are very few technologies from the 1850s that we still use today. That happens to be one of them. And even if you sand off the rough edges of it, it's still an outdated technology. It's a technology that leads to compliance. If you want compliance, use management. If you want engagement, self-direction is the path to engagement. And there's some interesting examples in the private sector of companies doing this.
And I want you to talk about Best Buy, because just this week, and Tim and I were just talking about before we came in, just this week, the Office of Personnel Management announced they're going to be doing, well, Tim, you talk about it, because you actually know about it better than I do.
Well, yeah, the Office of Personnel Management has actually announced that they're going to do some work very much like Best Buy has, and look at letting employees work wherever, whenever, in order to get things done and on a pilot basis to see if it works.
This is the results-only work environment, the ROWE.
Yes. And talk a little bit about how that works.
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically what it is it's relatively simple. People don't have schedules. You show up when you want. You don't have to be in the office at any time or at a certain time. You just have to get your work done. And so it's all about the results. It's sort of in some ways, and it's a brainchild of two, as you mentioned, Chris, HR executives formerly at Best Buy, Callie Ressler and Jody Thompson. And you know, they basically liken it to how you operate on a weekend. Let's say you're on a weekend and you have to get your laundry done. And you got to do your laundry and then you got to go to the grocery store. You're not saying, wow, I better make sure that this grocery store and laundry takes up from 9 to 12 before I go to lunch, or else someone's going to think I'm a slacker. No, you just get your laundry done and you get your groceries done, and you think about the results, the output, not the input. Almost any organization, whether it's a federal workforce or a for-profit organization, that moving from a status quo to results-only work environment is a very, very difficult thing. I think that in many cases, one of the scholars I write about talks about the need for scaffolding to get people there. And so I think that you start small. So maybe it is one day a month is results-only work environment day. In the same way that, 15, 20 years ago, federal workforce didn't really have much in the way of casual Friday or casual every day.
Right.
Everybody was coming in dolled up as if they were on Mad Men. And then, now, and so that started fairly gradually. I actually worked at the U.S. Department of Labor in the early 1990s and proposed at one point that the DOL model casual Fridays by having it internally to sort of loosen up the American workforce.
How'd that go?
It was basically, don't ever suggest that again. completely shut down. But now, if you look at the federal workforce, you have a little bit of that. So I think, you don't go row all the way, but maybe you do one day, or you do it within your division, or you do it within your team, one day a month, results only day. You don't have to show up at all. You just have to get your stuff done, and that might be a good start.
Dan, if management right now, particularly within the federal workforce, is even reluctant to have workers telecommute.
Yeah.
How do you make the jump from even telecommuting to something much more expansive?
I think that the way that it expands is incrementally. I just don't think you can do the full Monty. And so, but think about how much telecommuting has taken hold in the last 10 years. I mean, it's basically started from almost nothing to a little bit more than almost nothing. And I think that's how it works. I do think, and we were talking at the, I'll reveal to the listeners the scintillating conversation that goes on at the break. Chris was mentioning possible generational differences here. And I think that there's something to that. I don't put a lot of stock in generational explanations of things, but I think there is something to that. And as you know, we all know, the federal workforce is undergoing a pretty significant generational upheaval. And so maybe in the next 10 years or 15 years, as some of the more senior folks start retiring and some younger folks get in and the federal government becomes desperate for talent, then maybe some of these structures loosen up so that the change ends up being small, small, incremental, and then maybe it tips to bigger, more significant change.
One of the reasons why I invited Steve Ressler to participate in this is I think he actually is, you can use him in the follow-on versions of this book, because he is a person who actually gets to do mastery. He has purpose, and he actually has total autonomy over what he does.
Apparently, because he's in Florida right now.
In Florida, and does a great thing. So, Steve, as you hear about these ideas and these concepts of does this ring true to you, or does it seem like, hold on, with the carrot and the stick, we've been doing that a long time, why are we changing it?
No, I mean, I think it resonates with me in a lot of different ways, and, you know, just my personal life, you know, running government full-time in our small team, we kind of do row, so, you know, half the time you can find me working at Panera Bread or downtown downstairs on my couch watching The Real World while working, or you know, taking off at 3 but working on the weekend. I think it's all about getting the work done. But I do want to chip in on the generations piece. I think there's two things there where I think both the new generation, Generation Y, and the millennials come in. But with the baby boomers retiring, I think they are going to want row just as much. I come from a family of federal employees, and they're all retired in North Carolina and kind of a community with a lot of federal retirees. And they would all love to work, you know, 10, 20 hours a week remotely from, you know, North Carolina or Arizona or all these states where federal employees retire to. And you can really see the convergence of that there, right, where you can have both the new generations wanting these environments, but also these baby boomers who don't necessarily want to retire and play all day, but they want to work part-time. And they have a lot of lessons learned and ideas and still capable of doing, you know, great work into the 70s and 80s. So we get 5 or 10 hours of their time through these kind of unique programs, I think would be great.
You know, we hear about this a lot, the retiring baby boomers who maybe don't want to necessarily completely leave that workforce, and then the up-and-coming millennials and Generation Y. I'd like to hear somebody say something about Generation X once in a while. Hello. and where we, hi, that's me, would fit in all of this. I mean, I because part of me understands the concept behind Drive, Daniel, but part of me is kind of recoiling from some of your thoughts, not because I don't think they're good ideas. I'm it's hard to envision them, you know what I mean, in the workplace.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to envision because it doesn't exist right now, like anything that's, or it doesn't exist on any significant scale right now. Anything that we don't know precisely how these things are going to work, but there are all kinds of really cool examples out there of how this will work. And I have to say, I'm sort of, depending on how you categorize them, I'm either at the very end of the baby boom or the very beginning of Gen X, so I feel your pain about that being overlooked.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
But I mean, if you look at, I'll tell you one example that I really like of a company doing a really interesting thing. It happens to be a company founded by Gen Y people, but they have people of all generations working there. It's a company, it's an Australian company called Atlassian. It's a software company, and they do something really cool. Once a quarter on a Thursday afternoon, they say to their software developers, go work on anything you want, as long as it's not part of your regular job. Do it however you want, with whomever you want. All we ask is that you show what you created to the rest of the company on Friday afternoon in this kind of fun meeting. They call these things FedEx days because you have to deliver something overnight. It turns out that one day of intense, undiluted autonomy has led to a whole array of ideas for new products, a whole array of fixes for existing products that had otherwise never emerged. Now that's, you know, that, I mean, I can wrap my mind around that. I can, it's one day. We're not saying, it's not this kind of wild and woolly, show up whenever you want. It's one day, do whatever you want, show there's some accountability because you show the results, and it's worked really well.
And you also in the book talk about Post-it notes was developed in sort of that way.
Sure. I mean, this is, we talked about management as a technology, but in the world of white-collar work, the one technology even more important than management is, of course, Post-it notes.
Right.
And it turns out Post-it notes was created at 3M, but 3M for a long time has had something called 15% time, where people could spend 15% of their time working on whatever they wanted. And lo and behold, that the Post-it note came from some guy's 15% time. It was not an official project. I don't mean to treat it in a cursory way at all. I think it's actually pretty fundamental. I think it matters, though, in a way that is somewhat different from our intuition. Here's the thing. You got to pay people enough.
Yeah.
If you don't pay people enough, if people feel like they're being treated unfairly, if they can't support their families, you're not going to have any genuine motivation, all right? If people feel like they're getting a raw deal, you're going to have people who are motivated to work enough not to get fired. All right, so you got to pay people enough. I would argue, to the extent possible, harder in the federal workforce, you got to pay people more than enough. Basically, the best use of money is to take the issue of money off the table. Pay people enough so that they're not focused on the money, they're focused on the work itself. Beyond that, the research is pretty clear that additional units of money confer very little in the way of additional units of job satisfaction or performance. But you got to pay people enough. If you don't get to that threshold, then it's you don't even get into the conversation.
Because it does take some of the sting out. I mean, a nice big fat raise would take a little of the sting out.
Right, and the raises have to be right. The raises have to be fair. But what's interesting about that is how quickly people metabolize raises. That is, they get a raise, and then 2 weeks later, that becomes the new norm, and it's no longer motivating. It's just the norm. And so what you really, if you really want enduring motivation, other things matter more. And I think in the federal workforce, doesn't have the luxury of offering all kinds of economic incentives. I think they can rely on other things. We talked about autonomy, and Chris mentioned also a sense of purpose. And I think that in many ways, that is really the secret sauce. And we're seeing a little bit, I'm seeing glimmers of that being more and more important.
Tim, when we talk to you each week, we often are talking about, the mission of government. And it seems to me the federal government doesn't have a purpose problem. People who come to public service, they're generally doing it because they have a real sense of purpose, the environment or homeland or whatever choice that may be. And also the mastery thing. I think the feds do a B-minus job at the mastery part. It seems like the autonomy issue is just really problematic.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And just real quickly on the pay issue, I think one of the issues within government is that most jobs aren't market driven. So it's something that's set and it's not you're not looking comparable externally. And I think, Daniel, that's one of the points that you make
absolutely right
in the book. The second piece of it is that if you're only giving people incremental increases along the road, and you see that the person next to you is actually making the same thing but not actually performing at the same level, you've actually probably got an issue on the pay side of things as well.
Oh, yeah.
I think as it relates to autonomy, our best places to work rankings actually show that the greatest drivers of employee satisfaction in the federal government are really threefold. Leadership, which again, I think goes back to that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
If the leader is actually able to drive you to the mission, you're able to see that a skills and a mission match, which directly speaks to that purpose as well.
And the mastery
as well. And then there's the issue of work-life balance. And I think, while that's a huge driver, I think that's where it starts falling apart with the greater autonomy that we're talking about here.
Steve, you've been a Fed, and you've had to do this, and you actually, when you were at DHS, they did give you a certain amount of autonomy to live down in Florida and still be a Fed. They figured out how to make it work.
Yeah, I mean, and I think there's actually, people talk about one government, and, right, there's 3 million government employees and tons of different agencies, but in my division of Homeland Security, we had a half dozen folks that they pretty much implemented this, where they let us live wherever we wanted to live. Often it was for family reasons, but they trusted us because we were kind of high performers just to get the job done. So they didn't, as long as we were doing work, they were fine with it. And it actually caused greater loyalty, right? So if I was in D.C., there's a million kind of jobs I could get. But since teleworking, much, much fewer options and much more loyalty to the core group. And one of the big things that I see agencies could do better We talk about the mission and that agencies have it, but I don't think they do enough on the day-to-day to reinforce it. So one simple thing they did at my job is I worked for ICE Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and we had a 101 week where I was in the IT shop, and they literally sent us to the field. I went to L.A., Los Angeles, and went to, you know, detention centers. I met with lawyers. I met with everyone kind of on the front lines and spent a week kind of understanding how the technology I was providing was really helping improve the country, which sounds really, you know, you kind of know that theoretically, but going out and actually seeing that and talking to the real people using it, I think is really key. And government doesn't quite do enough of that. So I think, you know, if you're a contract officer for DOD, you know, actually going out to, you know, Iraq and seeing the things you're buying and the difference they're making, or going out to the shipyard, those little things like that are the kind of nuggets and rewards that versus pay, I think those things government can offer and brings more of that loyalty and going back to the mission.
It's a really definitive form of feedback, very specific form of feedback.
Tim.
Yeah. Again, I think you know, in looking at this, you know, one of the most challenging pieces of this for government is really that government is the epitome of actually the stick. Government doesn't reward innovation. Government doesn't reward you. So the carrot usually isn't even in play with government. It's the stick. If you screw up,
many sticks.
Right. If you screw up, do you want to be, if you take a risk, do you want to be the lead story on federal news radio? No, you don't. So in that case, in every other case, you do. So that's the stick that's out there. So even to Daniel, I love your point about you don't have to go from where you are now to row overnight or whatever the case is. But if you're as risk averse as the federal government is, even the trial and error, the error piece of that, you really are punished for that error. It's not a go ahead, make a few mistakes, get up, wipe yourself off, and get back on the horse again.
It's true, and I think it goes to your earlier point, Tim, about leadership. That is, or look at Steve. I mean, I think what Steve was describing about seeing how the individual work you do contributes to a larger whole. I mean, somebody in the federal workforce came up with that program. I mean, you know, it came to be because somebody had an idea and took a risk, and it ended up being a great thing. And I think that the good, you know, when you say that leadership was the top driver, that makes perfect sense to me because you think about when we think about our best bosses. You know, think about who your best boss was. Do you say, oh, that was my best boss because he breathed down my neck all the time. He controlled me all the time. I didn't get any better at what I was doing. Or do you say, hey, that person gave me a lot of freedom to do great things, helped me get better at my job, infused things with a sense of purpose. And I think that that's really where it comes down to. And I've changed my view on this. I used to think that leadership was nonsense. And I'm beginning to think that it's an extraordinarily important thing. And if you have effective leaders and there's some very effective leaders in the federal workforce, effective leaders who can try new things, run interference for the people beneath them, and can kind of navigate the tricky waters, those are some of the most sophisticated, skilled people around. A style of behavior that is more intrinsically motivated than extrinsically motivated.
As opposed to type A's.
We have type A's. Which are people who are just, you know, crazy, stressed out, in a hurry.
No one like that in this room.
Yeah. The curious thing about that is that there's not much of a correlation between type A behavior and any kind of professional accomplishment. It's just the big type I connection between type A behavior and heart disease. But type X is just type I and type X are another way of thinking about it. Type I more intrinsically than extrinsically. Type X more extrinsically than intrinsically motivated. And in general, type I's are happier and perform better.
Tim, I wanted to get your thoughts as you're reading through this book, and particularly how it applies to the people that we get to deal with every single day.
Yeah, again, I think there's a couple things we really do need to you know, kind of break the mold that we've been living in, which is one of don't try new things, and this does require us to try new things, and frankly, it's innovation, and when we talk about innovation, oftentimes we at the partnership say, you know what, innovation isn't necessarily taking something and creating it from scratch. There's actually things that are out there that have worked, so take nuggets of that. Figure out what works in your setting. And again, we might not be able to go from A to Z overnight, but how do we go from A to B?
Yeah.
And next week, we're going to talk to the folks at GSA about the Buy Project, where I think there are these examples of these things that are going on, where people are saying, oh, Lunt, we don't have to do the same way. We've always done it.
There's great stuff out there. And just, again, take that nugget.
Steve, give me your final thoughts in, we can take 40 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot in kind of this whole government 2.0 and open government movement that applies to this, where, you know, we're reaching out to, you know, all these employees and saying, you know, give us your best ideas and thoughts. And these are the apps for the Army contest, right, where instead of outsourcing application development, they actually ask all the soldiers, hey, form teams, create new projects. And they're doing it for intrinsic motivation. There may be some carrot of, you know, a $500 prize, but they're really doing it because it's cool. And they care about making the Army better. And I think more of those type of projects we can do in the government, the better, whether it's it did one for the best idea to save money for green inside the federal workforce with green energy. I think we just need to do more of those because people want to help out. There's millions of government employees. You just have to reach out and get their ideas and give them an opportunity to shine.